Welcome to all of you. It's so wonderful to have you here. Wonderful to be able to gather together for this annual event of spiritual renewal. Spiritual renewal won't come through my lectures. It won't come through events. It'll come more from what you can bring up within yourself. If we can stimulate you, inspire you, encourage you to put more energy into your attunement with God, to put more energy into your desire to seek Him, then the important aspect will be that enthusiasm, that inspiration, that encouragement that you feel to make a greater effort. And so in this week, don't think in terms of intellectual food. Think in terms of the vibrations that are all around you. You are living in the great ocean of God. We don't see that ocean because our minds are outward, and it's an inward thing. But it's always there. And if we can live in that consciousness, then we find that the vibrations of other devotees who have meditated here and have impermeated this whole land with the presence of God and of our gurus will have a real and lasting effect on your lives. This week I want to give the classes in order to introduce a new book, something that I've wanted to put together for many years. It's a book of sayings of Yogananda. After I finished The Path, I saw that I had many, many sayings left in my notebooks. And I thought, well, rather than put out another book now, let The Path do what it has to do, and let me also grow, and maybe in another 10 years or so, I'll be able to come at these teachings with perhaps even more mature, deeper, whatever, point of view. And in that greater maturity, perhaps be able to give something different in the sense of deeper. And so this year, I was in seclusion, and I had thought to do this book for several years, but it always frightened me because I had so many sayings on so many different subjects and how to put them all together. In fact, in 1960, I had already put them together in book form, and I wasn't satisfied. It was too much the sort of format of the sayings of Ramakrishna. I found that I was borrowing their way of outlining the thoughts, not borrowing the sayings, but the outline. And I thought, well, that's I want to do Master's thing. I want to do it the way he would do it. And so I thought, I'm not ready to do it as long as I can't let it come completely from inside. And so there was this fear, seeing all these things and thinking, how am I going to make something of them that isn't just a book of scattered sayings? I didn't want that. Sayings of that sort are sort of like Master being behind a screen on the stage and opening up the screen a little bit, coming out and delivering something hastily and then retreating back behind the screen again. And you don't know, it doesn't sink in deeply enough. It seemed to me that we needed sayings that would go deeply into the subject so you didn't just get a peripheral idea of what he thought on a particular subject, but that you really got a total view of his teaching, his essential teaching on that subject. And then what is his central teaching? Well, it all relates to the title, Self-Realization. He came here to teach us how to attain self-realization. And so I decided to call the book The Essence of Self-Realization. Well, pinning myself down to that was more frightening than ever, because did I have enough sayings just on that subject? I found marvelously that I could remember just verbatim things that he said that I hadn't written down. And where I didn't have enough sayings in any particular thing, or where there was a need for a particular thought to fill out what he used to teach on that subject. I would just sit there, and we had the good fortune to have an electric outage for almost a week. I had to write longhand, something I haven't done in many years. And it proved to be good fortune, not for the refrigerator and the things therein. However, it was a very great good fortune in the sense that I wasn't sitting there at my computer keyboard. I was sitting on a couch just meditating and listening. And it was as if he was speaking these words. I could remember him talking and writing in. I remember one passage I really wanted to remember his saying for a particular chapter, that it seemed to me it needed that, but I couldn't remember anything that he said, so I just had to leave it. But in many, many cases, I could remember things that he'd said on various occasions. Sometimes I would put things that he said here, here, and here, and put them together so that they would make a complete thing. Because this is the role of the disciples, to present the teachings of the guru in such a way as to be the way he taught. And so, not what he specifically said, but the way he taught, the things that he said, the complete message, rather than just sort of little islands in the sea. And so, I was able to come up with about, well, close to 300 sayings, and discovered to my amazement that I had enough for maybe two more books, and certainly one more book. And so I'll be doing that, if God gives me the strength and the life to do it, in the years to come. But this book, The Essence of Self-Realization, is the one that we're bringing out this fall. It will be out in the middle of September in the soft cover and the middle of October in the hard cover, which is a bit awkward because you usually release the hard cover before the soft cover. However, we'll work that out, and with you also, and if you insist on the soft cover, of course we'll make arrangements. And anyway, this book it was a thrill to work on it, because it was as if he was just right there the whole time. I was just filled with his presence, and I realized that this is the essence of what not just the spiritual path, but life is all about. And so this week, I hope, and I can't promise to do justice to such a great topic, but I hope to be able to make it at least interesting to you. Justice, I can't promise, but interest, I may be able to. That you will be able to get a glimpse, an insight into the deeper meaning of what human life is all about, and how it leads to the path, and how the path leads to God. In the Indian scriptures, the three philosophies Master pointed out, he said that, why does the Yoga Sutras, that the only ancient scripture on yoga is the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, and he said, why does it begin with that simple statement, now we come to the study of yoga? He said that's a very important sentence. It doesn't sound it, but that word now implies that there has been a previous study before yoga was approached. And the implication further is that that previous study is necessary in order really to understand what the science of yoga is all about. In other words, we need to come at yoga when we are prepared to take it up as a serious thing and not as a topic of cocktail party discussion and conversation. The three philosophies, the three basic philosophies of India, there are six basic ones in all, but these three relate to human life and enlightenment, are Sankhya, Yoga, and Vedanta. Vedanta teaches you the nature of the infinite and what we really are. Yoga teaches you how to attain it. Sankhya teaches you your need to attain it, your need to leave the world of the senses and to go within and to find a more subtle realm, a realm where not reason but intuition reigns supreme. This is these are the three philosophies. And until people have reached that point of really wanting union with God, which is what yoga means, really wanting to advance spiritually, it's better not even to teach yoga. Yes, a few little superficial things are okay. In fact, I remember a woman, and this is what made me use that expression earlier. A woman came to me at my meditation classes years ago in Sacramento. She had been taking, she'd taken before the series in yoga postures. And she said to me when she came for the meditation class, she said, "You know, I only took this course to begin with so I'd have something to talk about at my bridge parties." And she said, "You know, I've come to find that it's really serious." So it awakened something in her. And therefore, it isn't as if you want to keep it a secret from people who might be made ready. But in fact, nobody is ready to really take it up seriously until he's understood something about life being more than just fun and games or worries and disappointments. And so the first subject is Shankhya, to show you the illusory nature of this world, to show you the need for something more real and more lasting. Now, in this book, we begin with the study of what are essentially Shankhya subjects. The need for the folly of materialism, the need for a higher life, the true purpose of life. What is the nature of this universe? What is the nature of human life? What is our relationship to the infinite? And so on through the book as we'll go into it this week. But these first four aspects are what I want to go into a little bit, touch on this morning. The introduction to the book itself, and also I put it as the first saying in the first chapter, is a very simple saying. The truth simply is. It cannot be voted into existence. It must be perceived by every individual in the changeless self within. This is a statement that is it's very easy to accept intellectually, but very difficult to accept emotionally. That is to say that as long as you have a desire, it means that you're not able to accept what really is. Because if you accepted what is, you wouldn't bother to have a desire. You would simply work to do the best that you can to do something, and if it doesn't work, okay, never mind. But no, desire is like somebody at the horse races who sees his horse back in a position to come in first in the next race, and he's saying, "Come on, come on, come on," or he's seeing the two horses right almost neck and neck, and he's just trying to make his horse come out ahead and win, and this is how we are in life. Oh, if only this will happen. Oh, if only that doesn't happen. And we find ourselves constantly on the edge of our seats looking for something to be real that is or is not real. You find that this is why people, this is why Patanjali gave as one of his essential qualities for spiritual enlightenment the quality of non-truthlessness. Now, why didn't he simply say truthfulness? Why did he have to make it sound so complex? Non-lying. Why? Because the state of truthfulness is a natural state of the soul. There's no need to affirm that, really. What we need to do is get rid of those things that are not a part of our true nature. Get rid of the desire for things to be other than they are, and you're automatically truthful. You don't have to affirm truth. And so we need to look at life itself with a truthful gaze. Now, how can we do that? By detachment. We need to stand back from things. A thing that used to help me a lot as a lecturer. Master had me lecture the first time, and not only lecture, but lecture in his place the first time when I was 22. And it was a rather horrifying experience, as you can imagine. Also because I only learned about it Saturday morning. This was for Sunday morning service. And from then on, he had me speak regularly in the different churches. And I found that one thing that helped me very much to overcome the natural nervousness that one feels was to think, well, of course what I'm afraid of is that they'll think me a fool. Well, maybe I am a fool. In that case, what does it matter if they see it? And if I'm not, what does it matter if they think it? And so I became quite relaxed on the subject. I thought, well, whatever you think, the truth is what it is. And so I found that their opinion, good or bad, just didn't really touch the matter. And I found this again and again in my life, that when people come on strong with opinions about things, my tendency is to stand back and say, well, wait a minute, is it true? We can only know if a thing is true by consulting our inner intuition. I remember somebody who gave me a technique for arriving at a decision. And she said, make a list of all the pros, all the cons, all the reasons why you should and the reasons why you shouldn't, and so on. And then sort of add them up, and whichever list seems to be the longer, that seems to be the way to go. And I thought it was a pretty crummy system from the start. But as I analyzed it further, I saw that the reason that it is crummy is that reason is so inadequate as an instrument for arriving at truth. It can help, but you can have 1,000 reasons why a thing is so, and yet it may still not be so. And there is something inside you that if there is just one on that side of the ledger and all these are on the other side, all the contrary ones, if this one is based on intuition, it will be right and these will all be wrong. This is why in the story of the Bhagavad Gita, it's the basis of it is that the Pandava brothers were only 5. They were those who fought on the side of virtue, on the side of the soul. And the Kurus were 100. Those were on the side of material desire, of the ego. And the reason for that is that the world can give you all sorts of support, all sorts of reasons, all sorts of ways of enjoying. But the ways of intuition, the ways of the soul, are few, but are true. So don't worry about what the world thinks, because the world, by and large, is wrong most of the time. There are times when it's right, and you have to be willing to see it. That's what's wrong about the contrarian philosophy in economics. There's a lot to it. When most people go in a particular way, that usually will mean that it's time for things to go in the opposite way. But if you use that as your basis, as your philosophical basis for making your decisions, you're likely to be just as much influenced by externals as they are. Whereas if you consult your heart, you will feel. Now, this is the time to act this way. This is the way to speak. This is what I must do with my life. Always then, to see the truth of a situation, don't be influenced by feelings if they are upset, if there is any desire in them. In other words, feelings, which are the intuitive, it's the seat of intuition in the body. But if the feelings go outward rather than upward, then they lead to delusion. So if there's desire, if there is, if the ego's involved and you want this to be so, then don't trust it. If the feelings are upset or agitated in any way, be careful, get calm. What you should do when you feel devotion in your heart in meditation is direct it upward. What you should do when you feel a feeling and you don't know whether that feeling is right, is make sure that it's calm. Now, I've seen a lot of people saying, I'm perfectly calm, like this. Well, that's not the kind of calmness I'm talking about. But if you can take this feeling and direct it upward. One good thing would be to breathe deeply, and this would make the heart a magnet that would draw all those stray energy rays inward to the heart. Then sit in meditation and concentrate at the point between the eyebrows and direct that energy upward. When the heart and the head, that is to say the spiritual eye, the point between the eyebrows, when these are working together in harmony, when there's a flow upward from the heart to the spiritual eye, that's when intuition happens. Not just when it's feeling, because I've seen a lot of people have absolutely wrong feelings because they felt it, but it was agitated. So, truth. To see the truth of a thing, don't get too close to it. Don't get too involved with it. Don't be identified with it. Don't desire it in any way. Be calm in yourself. And from this point of departure, we can understand life. We can understand where we are headed in our lives and what we must do with our lives in order to get what we ourselves are looking for. So many people think of the spiritual path as something imposed upon them by Scripture, that we would be perfectly happy if only the Bible hadn't been written, for example. They look at these people in the South Seas who have never seen Scripture, never heard of Scripture. All they've got is their tribal taboos and totems and so on. And they think, now they're happy people. But all I can say is go and live with them for a while. You'll find that that's not so. I have not found happy people anywhere in this world, and I've done much more traveling than most people ever have done. I've only found happy people among those who sought God, among those who had His presence within. And they have a happiness which can never change. They have a happiness that is unshakable by outward circumstances. So even looking at it from the standpoint of the ordinary human being, involved as he is with worldly thoughts and not interested in spiritual ideals and principles, we find that life itself teaches us. It leads us very slowly, unfortunately. We have 60, 70, 80 years to make our mistakes, and then we forget them and have to start all over again. And the memory is left there as an impression, which in the average person is a very dim impression. It's only after a while that that impression begins to mount. You know how it is in life. You see something happen, and you think, gee, what a coincidence. Happens again, what a funny thing. Then it begins to happen more often. You think, wait a minute, maybe something's trying to happen. Somebody's trying to say something to me. And so it is over incarnations. We err, we suffer, we think, well, geez, too bad I suffered, but I'll just try again. And so they do the same thing over and over. And bit by bit, they find that there's a tie-in between the two. And so they begin to feel a little bit more questioning as to their own motives, their own actions, the rightness of them, and so on. And so bit by bit, they learn. But life itself teaches us. It may take a few million years from the beginning of our appearance as human beings, but whatever length of time it takes, I remember this one lady in Israel came up to Prahlad. She had been just reading a book on reincarnation, and very enthusiastically she said, guess what? We get to come back! Well, by the time people have reached the spiritual path, that's about the worst thing that can happen. This world begins to take on what Master described as you begin to develop toward it a sense of anguishing monotony. And you begin to long for something better. And that's when we come onto the spiritual path as such. But on the other hand, I remember a disciple saying to Master once, will I ever fall from the spiritual path? Master saw that he would. It was almost inevitable that he would. But he didn't want to discourage him, and so he replied, how could you? Everyone in the world is on the spiritual path, and that too is true. You can't possibly fall from the spiritual path any more than you can get away from God, because he's everywhere. And the spiritual path is living in this world and growing, whether by mistakes or by wisdom, but always we grow ultimately toward that final apotheosis where we realize that our true nature is God. And so the basis of our search must be the search for truth, for what is. Don't let the opinions and fads, the popular ideas of the moment seize you. Always stand back and say, yes, but is it true? If you will go to a used bookstore, for an author, there's nothing more depressing, and you look at all those old titles that nobody even remembers, but if you glance through them, those things which were practically scripture 100 years ago, and you read them now, or even things back in the 20s and 30s, and you read them now. Somebody gave me a book to read that was written in the 30s, and your only possible response to such a book is, my, how quaint. And yet to them it was real, it was now, it was shocking, it was revelation, it was new. Now, how quaint. And almost everything that people are thinking today, people will look on in 100 years and say, could they really think that way? Even now we see things like the hippie generation and so on. People look back and say, well, how naive. That they could find cosmic love through taking pot, for example. The very word pot tells how exalted their concepts are. One of the first thoughts that come to us when we try to look at life with an honest gaze, and mind you, to be able to look unflinchingly, and that's not easy always, because one of the first things that comes to you is the realization of how impermanent everything is. I went to a lecture, in fact, I was a part of the whole program, at the American Booksellers Association back in June in Las Vegas. And after me, Deepak Chopra spoke. He's written a book called Quantum Healing. He gave a really marvelous talk. But one of the lovely things I enjoyed in his talk was first a discussion on how every single part of our body changes constantly. He said that from the time you came into this room till now, many millions, billions of cells will have already left your body. And he said something rather horrifying to us all. He said, you've been breathing out these things, and how does it feel? This is a new way of looking at the brotherhood of man, that you're all exchanging your internal organs and you're breathing. But another thing he said was that here this body is changing constantly. And for those people who think they are the body, the question arises, which body do they think they are? The change of everything is a simple part of our daily reality, and yet our fear is that it will change. What a ridiculous fear. Of course it will change. I read something in a review of a book recently that the trouble with marriage is that women marry thinking that the husband will change, and the men marry thinking the wife won't change, and they're both disappointed. But everything undergoes a constant metamorphosis. And this life, if you think of it, when I look at pictures of myself when I was a young man, then I look at myself in the mirror. And if I don't look deeply, because when I look deeply, I see it's the same fellow. But when I look outwardly, there's a big difference. I saw some people who knew me many years ago, and they said, is it really Kriyananda? Makes you think a bit. Well, in the midst of all this, why do we try to hang on to something that won't be here in a very little while? To children, 1 year seems like a very long time. But to an adult, it seems much shorter. By the time you're 40, 50, 60, 70, it gets shorter all the time. Because the highlights have already been passed. And the milestones are familiar. And so you sort of take them for granted. You're living more in a now. But it won't be long before this very arm that you wash in the shower every morning will be ashes. We've got to face the fact that this life is impermanent. And our relations with each other, dear though they are, will not last on this level. Certainly they will continue through the magnetism of love, but it won't be husband and wife, it might be father and son. It might be daughter and mother, it might be brother and sister, it might be neighborly friends, it might be many things. We have so many different relations to go through with each other. And this very form that we have changes over a period of time. In fact, I was just thinking recently, to what extent can we even identify this outward form as our reality? Back incarnations ago, before we were human, it took on the form of a spider, a cockroach, a whale, a tree, a mosquito. It says that in the scriptures of India, it says it takes 5 to 8 million lives to reach the human level. And those 5 to 8 million lives cover a lot of forms on this planet. But we are none of those forms, nor are we this form. We are that spark of individuality deep within that is reaching out toward the light, that is reaching out toward infinite perfection and joy. So, one of Master's sayings here is, what is the use of spending all one's time on things that don't last? The drama of life has for its moral the fact that it is merely that, a drama, an illusion. Fools, imagining the play to be real and lasting, weep through the sad parts, grieve that the happy parts cannot endure, and sorrow that the play must at last come to an end. Suffering is the punishment for their spiritual blindness. The wise, however, seeing the drama for the utter delusion it is, seek eternal happiness in the self within. Life, for those who don't know how to handle it, is a terrible machine. Sooner or later, it cuts them to pieces. You must realize that life, if you don't work in harmony with it, will work against you. And how can you work in harmony with it? You try to work in harmony with this human being, and that one becomes your enemy for choosing him. You try to work in harmony with the arts and the beauty of nature, and suddenly the practical aspect of the law takes over and gives you a beating. You can't work with life outwardly and win. You just can't. Whereas if you can tune in to the divine and allow that divine to work with you, then you find that things just happen in marvelous ways. I had a lovely manifestation of that last week. I was to go downtown, and I had to get something before I could go, but the person who was to give it to me wasn't available. And so I had to wait. I wanted to leave early, but I had to wait, and I waited about an hour or longer, and finally that person came and brought me what I needed, so I was ready to go. Well, suddenly by that time I began to realize that I wasn't really feeling quite all that well. I'd felt before there wasn't something all that right, but I didn't know what it was. And so I thought, well, okay, I'll get up and go anyway. And I started to put everything in my pockets to leave, and I began to feel, well, really, I'm unwell. So I went and I lay down thinking, let me lie down for half an hour and see how I feel. Within 15 minutes, I was starting to shake like a leaf in a high wind. And I had a high fever, and it's just very lucky that I didn't find myself shaking like that on the freeway. I might have driven over a cliff or something. I couldn't even put a glass of water to my lips to drink because my hands were just going like that. And if I hadn't been delayed that hour, I would have found myself on the freeway. So you see, the divine worked out my delay in wonderful ways. And then what happened was that Dr. Peter had a completely full afternoon and wouldn't have been able to come and see me except at the last minute. Four people in a solid block of time canceled. And so he came right over. That was the first part of the afternoon. And so you find that when you're in tune, then somehow things work well. And when you're not in tune, somehow you can scheme, you can manipulate, you can start lawsuits, you can cheat, you can do anything you want to, and somehow at the end you've always got the loser's end. So remember, life is a terrible machine until you can learn how to work with it. And the only way to work with it is to work with him who is operating this machine. And that will never be you. You are not in the driver's seat. He is running this show. We have to get in tune with him, and then everything seems somehow to flow wonderfully. But because of desires, because of wanting things to be this or to be that, we're always sort of living in the future. We need to be able to live in eternity, to remember that now is forever. But that whatever was, is, and whatever is, always will be. And don't, therefore, chop what you see up into time segments so much. But I remember how bound we are. I remember one day I had my watch in for repair, and I couldn't believe how many times I looked at my wrist to see the time. Just a matter of habit. I couldn't believe it. We get so bound by time, by the phases of life. Rather, Master used to say, don't think how old you are. He would never say how old he was, because he said, if I live in a house, shall I say my age by the age of the house? The age of the house has nothing to do with how old I am. And so we should live always in the consciousness that we are eternal, that we live in a timeless now. And so Master said once, and this is a lovely illustration of the way that desires keep us always edging forward, and never really getting anywhere, but pulling a great load of worries and preoccupations and suffering behind us. Yogananda said, I once saw a cartoon drawing of a dog hitched to a small but well-laden cart. The dog's owner had found an ingenious method for getting it to pull the cart for him. A long pole tied to the cart extended forward over the dog's head. At the end of the pole there dangled a sausage, temptingly. The dog, straining in vain to reach that sausage, hardly noticed the heavy cart he was dragging along behind him. How many business people, Master said, business people, but how many people everywhere, in fact, are like that? They keep thinking, if I can make just a little more money, I'll find happiness at last. Somehow their sausage of happiness keeps receding from their grasp. As they strain to reach it, however, just see what a cartload of troubles and worries they drag along behind them. We all have a great deal of the consciousness of material poverty. We are fortunately, by and large, a materially prosperous country. There's poverty here too. But still, we try to avoid that poverty by investing rightly, and we don't want to lose our jobs. We're afraid that if we do, we'll suddenly be reduced to penury. Master used to say that the real poverty is spiritual poverty. Material poverty is not the cause of suffering. Spiritual poverty is the cause of suffering. Now you may say, well, but I know that during the Depression years we suffered a lot because we didn't have money. No, you suffered because you were spiritually poor and didn't know how to find wealth except in outward things. Surely it's hard on the body not to have food to eat. That is granted. That's a certain amount of physical suffering, yes. But even that wouldn't happen if you were in tune. People who are deeply in tune, I've always remembered that story of the Saint Anthony of the Desert, who went to see another saint whose name was Paul. And Paul had no way of having any food brought to him, but there was a raven who brought him half a loaf of bread every day. And God in this way fed him. When Saint Anthony went to visit him, he brought a whole loaf. This may seem like a lovely myth, But you know, this world is full of very strange happenings, and on the spiritual path, you begin to find those things happening to you. And you begin to realize that when you are spiritually rich inwardly, God gives you what you need. He doesn't give you more necessarily, but He gives you that. Durga was saying a few days ago that if this country should fall into a depression, we won't suffer as much just because we'd be perfectly happy to go back to what we had before. In the beginning years at Ananda, we didn't have bathrooms, we had outhouses. We didn't have electricity, we had gas lights. Many people had teepees. We were perfectly happy. As long as you're covered, you're free. In fact, the larger the house, the more expenses it incurs. Simplicity is the way to happiness. And so we must learn to seek our wealth within ourselves and not in the bank account that we build up. Master said on that subject, possession of material riches without inner peace is like dying of thirst while bathing in a lake. If material poverty is to be avoided, spiritual poverty is to be abhorred. For it is spiritual poverty, not material lack, that lies at the core of all human suffering. And so what we need to do is realize that if we want to find truth, we mustn't be always preoccupied with outward things, shining everything up, polishing everything up, accumulating things. You go into some people's houses and you're just about to sit down. Oh, no, no, don't sit there. That's an antique. And you can't touch anything. You can hardly breathe on anything. You go into some homes where there's so much clutter that you can hardly walk. How much nicer it is when one can have just simple life, just a few necessities, but not more, and live more inside himself. Thoreau said, the fruit of luxury is luxury. Whether in the mind, whether in one's outward possessions, whatever it might be. When you have luxury, it leads you toward a luxurious attitude. Now, a luxurious attitude is like an unpruned tree. A pruned tree looks neat and right, but an unpruned tree sort of grows in all directions. And in the same way, the mind, when it tends toward too much luxury, the mind too sort of spins out into thinking of all the various things it can have, it can do, it can be, and as a result, it never returns back to itself, and never finds the source of its peace. As Master said, people forget that the price of luxury is an ever-increasing expenditure of nerve and brain energy, and the consequent shortening of their natural lifespan. Materialists become so engrossed in the task of making money that they can't relax enough to enjoy their comforts even after they've acquired them. How unsatisfactory is modern life? Just look at the people around you. Ask yourself, are they happy? Now, when I say this, I don't mean look left and right today. I hope you're all happy. So let's assume that Master meant another gathering. See the sad expressions on so many faces. Observe the emptiness in their eyes. A materialistic life tempts mankind with smiles and assurances, but is consistent only in this, and this is a wonderful thought. It never fails eventually to break all its promises. Every single joy that we think we're going to get in the end lets us down. Every fulfillment in the end lets us down. It cannot do otherwise because it's not ourself. And all that we're really seeking is ourself everywhere. We're looking in mirrors. We think we're seeing other things, and we're only seeing reflections of ourselves, reflections of our desires. But behind all the fulfillments of life, there is always pain and disappointment. Why? It doesn't seem fair in a way. Well, why? We'll talk about it a little bit in greater depth later on, but basically we can simply put it this way, that life is founded, the very manifestation of life was made possible by the law of duality. And so there is bound to be a constant, well, it's like a swing, constantly going from one side to the next, and it couldn't sustain itself on one side only. The nature of the world is such that it needs both sides to remain balanced, because God's in the center. God could create this world only by creating an appearance of two opposites, joy and sorrow, pleasure and pain, love and hatred, heat and cold, and so on, light and darkness, and so on. All of these are a part of the constant flux of nature. Heraclitus's principle was panta rei, all is flux. And this is the nature of life, it's the nature of your life. Now, the thing is that people think that this side is pleasure, this side is pain. So let me push the swing further and further and further away from pain, and that way I won't have to suffer pain. If I can find absolute pleasure, a beautiful million-dollar home and a lovely family and all the money in the bank I could possibly want and a great swimming pool and lovely everything, fame, riches, whatever. If I push it all the way here, I'll have everything I could possibly want. And nature is not made to allow that to happen. And so, what happens when you push a swing further one direction? Does it just swing to the middle? Certainly not. The farther you push it here, to the right, the farther it'll swing over to the left. And so those people also experience a great deal more pain than other people do. People look enviously at the rich, but very often you will find that unless they use their lives and their money for good things, they are much less happy than poor people. I have seen wonderfully happy smiles on the faces of poor people. I'll never forget some gypsy children in Bucharest when we were children, and we went to the skating rink. And there were these gypsy children outside it who came up. They've got this wine that they've developed over who knows how many generations in Romania that says, "I haven't eaten for 3 days like this." Nu am mâncat pentru 3 zile. And you'd think that they're the most pathetic creatures in the world. So we gave them something, and then we went in and skated. And then when we came out, we saw these same children laughing and dancing in the streets and having the best time. And then they saw us and they said, "Ah, nu am mâncat pentru 3 zile." But basically, I have been in parts of the country where people didn't have anything. They might have $40 a year, a year income, and yet they were happy, they were peaceful. And I have been in some of the wealthiest homes, and I have seen very few smiles, very little of that kind of radiance that I saw among poor people. And so you see, even in that lack of the very happiness they thought they could buy, is already something of that movement of the swing in its opposite direction. But such is the karmic law. As Master said, behind every rosebush of pleasure, there lies hidden a rattlesnake of suffering and pain. And that's a good point to remember. Always remember that joy, if you can find it inside yourself, at your center, to that there is no opposite. You won't have to experience the extreme loss of spiritual joy. You can experience its increase to infinity, and you'll never lose. You'll never find an opposite to it if you live in that. But outward joy will have its compensating pain. One thing that Master used to emphasize again and again, and this is something that I really appreciated in his teaching, he told us, don't accept what the scriptures say, but experiment in your own lives and find out if they're true. People have said many strange things in the name of truth. Find out for yourself if they really are true, because some of them are not. He talked about somebody who had a dream, or rather he claimed to have had a dream. What happened was, first he went to a tree and buried a scripture under the tree about 6 feet down. He just wrote this whole scripture himself. Then 15 years later, he claimed to have had this vision that an angel had told him that this scripture was buried under a tree, and he did all sorts of mumbo-jumbo and finally arrived at the right spot and dug, and lo and behold, the miracle, there was this scripture. Well, there have been many things said in the name of truth that are pure imagination. But if you experiment in your own life, you will find what is true and what is false. And so the essence of spiritual growth, the essence of truthfulness with respect to living, is to be always looking and see whether what you thought was so really was so or not. That's been one of the wonderful things in living at Ananda, is this total commitment to finding out for ourselves if this is really true or not. And then what we find is that people have faith in these teachings rather than merely quoting them and believing in them in a fanatical way. Master said on this subject, addressing a large audience in America, "Modern man takes pride in his scientific approach to reality. Let me then make this proposal, that you analyze life itself, in a laboratory, as it were. Americans love to experiment, so why not experiment on yourselves, on your attitudes toward life, on your thoughts and behavior? Find out what life is, and how human life might be improved. Discover what people most deeply want in life, and what is the best way for them to achieve that heart's desire. Find what it is they most want to avoid, and how they might in future avoid this unwelcome guest. In physics and chemistry, if a person wants the right answers, he must ask the right questions. The same is true also in life. Try to find out why so many people are unhappy. Then, having understood that, seek the best way of achieving lasting happiness. Why are they unhappy? Because they live outside themselves. Everybody, the more they live outside themselves, the more they suffer. We have a wonderful slideshow called Different Worlds. And it's pictures, slides from around the world of different individuals. And I was able with the zoom lens to come in close so they wouldn't see I was taking pictures of them. But I could see how people in different walks of life, people with different attitudes, how pain always seemed to accompany an outward flow of consciousness. And the more they lived within, the more they lived servicefully, the more they lived without emphasizing ego consciousness, the more peaceful they seemed to be. It's a wonderful lesson that it teaches. And then you see people who are on the path, people who meditate. There's always that serenity. There's always that glow about them, because they're living from within outward. Well, look at life in that way. These are the questions to ask, because what is it everybody's really wanting in life? We're all looking for happiness, or at least we're looking for ways to escape the pain that we're suffering. We all want that. So these are the questions to ask, rather than how do I get richer? How do I find that home I'm looking for? How do I vote the right party into power in Washington and so on? Those are not essential. In fact, at the ABA in my talk, I said that the real contest in our age is not between capitalism and communism. The struggle is between those who think that matter is the ultimate reality and those who think that consciousness is the ultimate reality. This is what we've got to see then. Master said, insist on finding practical solutions, formulas that will work for everyone. One's approach to life should be as scientific as the physicist's to his study of the universe. Religion itself should adopt a more scientific approach to life. It should seek practical solutions to life's fundamental problems. Indeed, spiritual principles offer the most universally practical solutions there are. So once we've reached the point of understanding that this world is not what we really, it can never give us what we really want, or if you want to look at it statistically, and you look around you, you have to say that really it hasn't given anyone else what they wanted, so why should you think it'll give you what you want? Many people think that others die, but they'll live forever, ever. Many people see others suffering and they think, well, I'll get it together, I'll win, I'll somehow make my pile, I'll somehow find my happiness. But what happens everywhere is what happens also to you. You die in the end. Nothing that you have now will remain with you. And you too will suffer unless you learn to live in the right way. And so it is that you begin to feel a little bit of a withdrawal, and you ask yourself, well, if that's not why I'm here, What is the true purpose of life? And this is the title of the next chapter in the book, The True Purpose of Life. And in this, there's a question that I think begins to come to people as they get more sensitive. Have you ever felt yourself to be sort of a stranger, surrounded by friends, and yet somehow, yes, they're friends, they're dear to you, but somehow also there's something that's not you? I remember, I mentioned this in the path too, where I was with a group of friends on a beach having a weenie roast or something or other back in college. And I began suddenly to feel, because here we were, just a little group of people on an abandoned beach, huddled around a little fire, desperately trying to create a little reality of our own, and yet beyond it was this vast empty beach, the sea, and sort of a mist that had come down that made it seem as if eternity was something, infinity, were things that were so much greater and that continued there. We left the beach and those were still there. And I remember this mood came on me of just deep aloneness. And I went away from the group and just sat down on the sand and thought, but I'm in touch through this night with everything. That somehow this darkness, these clouds, this ocean unites me with people on the other side of the sea. And this little group of people, classmates in college, that's only a small part of what's going on in my life and in their lives. I think that one of the first things that brings people to a desire for understanding the true purpose of life is this sense of being a stranger in this world, a stranger in a foreign land. Master addressed that thought when he said, "Those who are immersed in body consciousness are like strangers in a foreign land, only they don't know it. Our native country is omnipresence. On earth we are but travelers, guests on a brief visit. Unfortunately, most people make undesirable guests of themselves. They insist on monopolizing a small portion of this earth as their very own. Their constant thought is, my home, my wife, my husband, my children. Material entanglements, sweet and mysterious, keep them dreaming through the sleep of delusion. They forget who and what they really are. Wake up before your dream of life vanishes into the infinite. When this body drops in death, where will your family be? Your home, your money? You are not this body. The body is only a plate given to you that you might eat from it, the feast of spirit. Why not learn this essential lesson before life? Why wait? Don't tie yourself to the limitations of human consciousness, but remember the vastness of the spirit within." And there you have the essence of the purpose of life, to remember that it's not out there, it's in here. It's not in this physical body, it's in the spirit that dwells within, behind the atoms of this body. Life is a school intended to help us to learn that lesson. All the pains, you know, when your horse doesn't come in, let's say, to use that illustration, and you think, oh, or you see that horse actually coming in at first and then the second race, you're just sort of, oh, what a disappointment. So what happens when you're disappointed? It's all very much tied to the flow of energy in the ira and pingala, the prana and apan energies in the spine, which is a subtler aspect of the science of yoga. But in fact, it's the essence of, it's the very meaning of hatha in hatha yoga. Ha refers to this upward movement of current in the ira. Tha refers to the downward movement of energy in the pingala. And when we have this upward surge of energy, it accompanies always a sense of enthusiasm, recognition, wakefulness, hope. Oh, good. And then when we're disappointed, there's this downward movement, a movement away from happiness if we don't understand things properly, or a movement away from attachment if we understand things truly, a movement back into our center. That's why breathlessness, you remember in Autobiography of a Yogi, Master talked about the breath being sucked out of his lungs as if by a mystic syringe, And in that breathlessness, then he experienced samadhi. Well, as that energy comes down, it accompanies the exhalation. As the energy comes up, like that, when you're disappointed, you sigh. It reminds me of a football game that my parents went to in France. It was American football, and the French had heard a lot about the violence of American football. And they remembered somebody got hurt, and suddenly, everybody was all excited, and then the same runner who was carried off the field a few moments later ran back. The whole crowd. Anyway, with that exhalation and that downward movement of energy, if you take it in a spiritual way, withdrawing into yourself, then you go into the deep spine, and then you can raise your current up through the deep spine into the divine consciousness. And so, we have to have the understanding of life teaching us this to the point where we realize that this up and down, this excitement and disappointment gradually teaches us to go more and more within. You will find that when people are bitterly disappointed, they say, no, I'm not disappointed, they just affirm themselves. Well, this is good if they would only not think of it negatively. It's very good to realize that you are the only reality you'll ever know. And the more you can live this way, the closer you'll come to the higher reality. Well, life gradually tries to teach us this lesson. It takes a long time because human, as they say, hope springs eternal in the human breast. And this human capacity for enthusiasm is practically endless. If you blow it in one lifetime, there's another lifetime to try all over again. But bit by bit, you learn that it's just not going to happen. It's just not going anywhere. And you begin to get your strength inwardly. It doesn't make you negative. It makes you positive, but in a real way, because you understand that finally the things that happen right are those things which come from inside, from my strength, from my understanding, rather than my depending on outward things to give me what I want. And so Master said the true purpose of life is to know God. Worldly temptations were given you to help you develop discrimination. Will you prefer sense pleasures? Or will you choose God? Pleasures seem alluring at first, but if you choose them, sooner or later, you will find yourself enmeshed in endless troubles and difficulties. Loss of health, of peace of mind, and of happiness is the lot of everyone who succumbs to the lure of sense pleasures. Infinite joy, on the other hand, is yours once you know God. Every human being will have eventually to learn this great lesson of life. Now, what accompanies the sense of disappointment very often is a loss of energy. You lose the courage to try again. You lose the enthusiasm to do things creatively. And people, when they're in that mood, then they can't grow spiritually. There is in all of us a life wish and a death wish. The one brings us upward toward enlightenment. The other one brings us back into a cessation of worry because we're unconscious. And many people try to kill their consciousness either by disappointment and refusing to think about things or trying to escape even into drugs or too much sleep or drinking or whatever it might be. But in everybody, suicide is not just killing the body, literally. Suicide is a natural need, or I should say, a natural quality of human nature. Everybody's got it in one way or another. Even if it's only a wish to close your house up for a weekend and just be alone. That's a bit of that wish to negate. Unless it's a wish to really go into deep meditation. But every time you go to sleep at night, you're expressing a little bit of that. And so it is that people gradually lose the fine edge of enthusiasm, and they become what Jesus used to talk about when he said, let the dead bury their dead. They become people who don't have any enthusiasm. One reason they don't have it is that they're afraid of being hurt by other people. They say, oh, isn't this wonderful? Oh, come on, what kind of lousy taste have you got? Oh, the next time you think, well, maybe I better not say I like it. Or you say, I love you. Yeah, well, I don't love you. I think you're a rat. And so you're afraid to say it again. And so again and again people get hurt. And bit by bit they sort of close down until finally they can't express that kind of life without which we can't grow in God. Now there has to be a way out. Master addresses that subject here. He said, think for a moment what Jesus meant when he said, let the dead bury their dead. His meaning was that most people are dead but don't know it. They have no ambition, no initiative, no spiritual enthusiasm, no joy in life. What is the use of living that way? Life should be a constant inspiration. To live mechanically is to be dead inside, though your body be still breathing. The reason people's lives are so dull and uninteresting is that they depend on shallow channels for their happiness instead of going to the limitless source of all joy within themselves. What we need to do is learn to say yes to life. One of the most important things that Master taught was the energization exercises. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands as to how many people do them, but I know from sad experience that people who don't live in a community where they have the incentive of other people doing them very often fall away from doing those exercises. And yet they are marvelous. You don't notice much effect. If you're expecting a thunderclap every time you do the energization exercises, you may be disappointed. But you will find that after a little bit, you begin to feel so much energy in doing them that you begin to think of yourself as a body of energy. You find then that you've got the power to do whatever you need to do and do it well. They are such a marvelous source of that exact kind of enthusiasm and energy that Master was talking about when he quoted Jesus in this. That when you can feel yourself as a body of energy and not as just this heavy lump of flesh, then you will see that that energy, and this is why I call it a cornerstone of the teachings, because it gives you not only a sense of energy and enthusiasm, but also it gives you a sense of that energy which you can withdraw from the senses and direct upward toward God. It's good to do things with enthusiasm. Whatever it is that you're doing, do it with enthusiasm. And then take that same awakened energy and direct it inward and meditate with that same kind of enthusiasm, and you will see that your meditations also become deeper. Many people on the spiritual path think that they shouldn't do anything outwardly. All their energy should go within. But then their consciousness of this energy in the body and therefore in the mind gradually diminishes. And I've seen a lot of sadhus in India who really are pretty dull people because they don't have that inner awakened energy. That's why they're a cornerstone of the teachings. Pranayama, kriya is a kind of pranayama. Hongso is a kind of pranayama. The control of energy. When you are aware of the energy, you can practice those pranayamas much more effectively. So think of yourself as a body of energy. Master said this universe is a dream of God's. Its very vastness suggests the limitlessness of consciousness. Just imagine a sphere of light. Visualize it expanding through eternity with the speed of thought. Could it ever reach a point where further expansion was impossible? Never. Though matter has limitations, consciousness has none. Don't you see that is what this universe is? Infinite because the capacities of consciousness are infinite. Even as thought precedes action, so matter, like that expanding sphere of light, filled the space which thought had created for it. The basic substance of the universe is consciousness. Matter itself was simply thought into existence, first as energy and then as matter. For matter is only energy on a grosser level of manifestation. Modern science has made this discovery. And scientific meditation long ago made the discovery that cosmic energy is simply a projection of the will of God. And so if you want to unite your will with God's will, then you have to first realize that your energy is the projection of your will. That's why the basic principle in the energization exercises is this one, the greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. If you will a lot of energy to your arm, you'll find that there's no limit to how much you can fill your arm with. So, in your life, if you are lackluster, it's not because things have made you that way. It's not because life's disappointments have made you that way. It's not because people haven't given you or circumstances haven't given you the opportunity to do what you wanted to do. It begins with you. You can be in a prison with nothing, and still you can be filled with this energy and enthusiasm if you keep your mind on God. That's a beautiful thing in the autobiography of Benvenuto Cellini, where he was actually put in prison by the Pope because he wouldn't finish a statue until the Pope paid him. And the Pope wasn't about to pay him, but he did have power to put him in prison. And so, whatever the spiritual lessons of this are involved, I'm not going to venture on. However, Cellini later came out. He said that he had nothing then in prison except bread and water, a soggy mattress, rats that ran around the floor at night. He had a Bible and nothing else to read. And there was a window high up that gave a little bit of light for maybe 2 hours a day. And then it was too dark to read by. And during those 2 hours, he would read the Bible, and the rest of the time he prayed. And when he was finally allowed out by the Pope, who finally gave in because Benvenuto Cellini was a stubborn man and wouldn't give in, when he came out, he wrote a poem. And he said, if you want to find what real happiness is, then arrange to be put in a dungeon with nothing but bread and water and rats on the floor and a soggy mattress, and spend your time reading scripture and praying. And so it is that if we can live in this inward way, then we can find what we're looking for. And that means your willpower. He had the willpower to do what had to be done. Others, not knowing anything about God, have still been able to react by keeping their bodies busy and so on. It all comes down to your willpower. If you have the will, you can be happy under any circumstance. And if you don't have the will, you can be in heaven itself and still find things to be unhappy about. So you must be strong in yourself. And if you want to find God's will, He directs the energy that created the universe. You have to function in a divine way by directing consciously the energy in your body toward what you do. Realize that it's your energy that's doing it. It's your energy that accomplishes what you do. It's your energy with which you pray and meditate. And then you will be able to find Him. As I was saying earlier, think of yourself as eternal. Think of yourself as living in eternity. Master said, these few years of your earth life are just so many seconds compared to the eons before you were born, and to the endless reaches of time still to come, long after you leave this world. Why be identified with this brief material interlude? These are not your body, your family, your country. You are only a visitor here. Your homeland is infinity. Your true lifespan is eternity. That's why it says in the scripture somewhere, you are of old, O Son of Man, yea, of everlasting. That's why Jesus could say also, before Abraham was, I am. We could make that affirmation too. The difference was that he could remember. He lived in that eternity. That's why he didn't even say, before Abraham was, I was. Or I had been. He said, I am. Because to him, even then, that was now. The whole scene through the eons and eons of time is all happening right now in the mind of God. It's like a movie. You can move the movie forward or backward. And yet, sitting in the movie theater, watching it, it can span a whole lifetime, but you can see it in a matter of minutes. So is God, only even those minutes don't pass. He just sees these scenes passing. Time remains unmoved, because He is unmoved by movement. The purpose of life, then. Oh, there was one more saying I wanted to add here, too. And that is something that Master emphasized, which is don't live by what other people think. We waste a whole lifetime doing that. We worry what other people are going to think of us. Master one time had a group of nuns doing the energization exercises on the lawn in a public park. And all the cars driving by were looking like this, and the women were getting very embarrassed. And Master said, don't worry about that. They only think it's strange because they don't do it. And it's certainly the case. People think you're odd if you're different from them. Well, the truth is, they're the ones who are odd. Because if anybody's out of God, he's the one who's abnormal. And to the extent that you're living in God, you have found at least some degree of normality in yourself. But comport yourself in such a way that God is pleased. If God is pleased, the opinions of people simply don't matter. Master said, people live too much vicariously in the opinions of others. If you want to have life and have it more abundantly, as Jesus taught, you must begin by living your own life and not that of anyone else. Your primary concern should be how to win the Lord, not how to please your fellow man. Never lose sight of God. This world will go on without you. You are not as important as you think. Into the dustbin of ages, countless billions of people have been thrown. It is the Lord's recognition we must cultivate, not other people's. And so, he concluded this chapter, the purpose of human life is to find God. That is the only reason for our existence. Job, friends, material interests, these things in themselves mean nothing. They can never provide you with true happiness for the simple reason that none of them, in itself, is complete. Only God encompasses everything. That is why Jesus said, seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added unto you. Seek ye first the giver of all gifts, and you shall receive from him all his gifts of lesser fulfillments. What we need to understand, and this is one of the first things that happens to a person when he begins to think seriously. First of all, he realizes life isn't giving him what he wants. Then he begins to say, well, what do I want? What am I here for? What is this life for? And then he begins to ask himself more deeply, what is real? It's something that comes to everybody sooner or later in his long evolution through many incarnations. He begins to remember his sleep state. And he says, well, what seemed so real when I was sleeping doesn't seem real anymore now that I'm awake. What if I'm dreaming right now? Isn't that something you've all thought at one time or another? It's just a natural thought that comes to the human being as he's suddenly getting ready to really seek truth earnestly. He begins to see, well, this isn't real. There's nothing in it that's real. It's almost like a ghost trying to grab a chair and can't do it because he's in a different vibration. You try to grab this world, and even though you think you're holding that chair, you're really not holding anything. Is it really possible that it's just a dream? And so this third chapter is called The Dream Nature of the Universe. And we find that there are three levels of consciousness, and only one of them is the reality. There's the subconscious, the conscious, and the superconscious. On a superconscious level, we perceive reality as it is. On a conscious level, we break up that reality and never see it as it really is because it's always fragmented. On a subconscious level, we create our own realities and they aren't real at all. And so what we need to do is try to lift our minds out of subconscious, not dwell too much on a conscious level, but try to live as much as possible on a superconscious level. In this first saying, in this chapter, Master said there was a farmer standing by a tree absorbed in thought. His wife came rushing up weeping to announce that their only son had just been killed by a cobra. The farmer made no reply. Stunned by his seeming indifference, the wife cried, "You are heartless." "You don't understand," the farmer replied. "Last night I dreamed that I was a king and that I had seven sons. They went out into the forest and all were bitten by cobras and died. Now I am wondering whether I ought to weep for my seven dead sons in that dream or for our one son who has just been killed in this dream we are dreaming now." The farmer was a man of spiritual vision. To him, the material world and the subconscious dream world were both equally unreal. When we dream at night, this present dream fades into unreality, and only that subconscious dream world seems real to us. When we return again to the dream of this world, that other dream is forgotten. Everything exists only in consciousness. And the next saying, too, is beautiful. A man is sleeping and dreams that he is a soldier. He goes into battle, fights bravely, then is fatally wounded. Sadly, he dreams of his approaching death. Perhaps he thinks of the dear ones he must leave behind. Suddenly he wakes up. In joyful relief, he cries, "Ah, I'm not a soldier and I am not dying. It was only a dream." And he laughs to find himself alive and well. But what of the soldier who actually fights in this earth life and is wounded and killed? Suddenly, in the astral world, he wakes up to find that it was all just a dream. That in that other world he has no physical body, no flesh to be wounded, no bones to be broken. Don't you see? All the experiences of this world are like that. They are nothing but dream experiences. Some people have the idea that we dream this world into existence. This is easy to do, to explode in this way. That could you, therefore, dream the plays of Shakespeare? Could you dream some great architectural triumph like the Taj Mahal? A lot of people have tried. Only one or two people in history have succeeded. It isn't your dream, you see. God's the one who's dreaming this dream through you. I know that some Zen Buddhist told me a few years ago, when I die, the whole universe will cease to exist. Well, but I'll be living. It was a completely unreal assessment of the Buddhist philosophy. Yes, it's all thought. Yes, it's all a dream. But it's not your dream. And so Master said, this world seems real to you only because God dreamed you into existence along with his cosmic dream. You are a part of his dream. If at night you dream that you bump your head against a wall, you may get an imaginary pain in your head. The moment you awake, however, you realize that there was no wall there to hurt you. The pain you experienced was in your mind, but not in your head. The same is true of this dream you are dreaming now. Wake up to the one reality, God, and you will see that this earth life is just a show. It is nothing but shadows and light. Master often used the illustration of the movie to express how similar this world is. And so in a saying that's very, very close to that one, he said, in a movie, the action seems very real. If you look up to the projection booth, however, you will see that that whole story is being produced by a single beam of light. That is how this great movie of creation was made. God said, "Let there be light." Out of the great beam of cosmic light was manifested the entire universe. It is a cosmic movie in many ways like the one in the movie theater. Much of the difference is in degree. In a movie theater, what you behold is two-dimensional and is true only to the senses of sight and sound. The cosmic movie is three-dimensional and is true also to the senses of taste, smell, and touch. The movie you see in the movie theater may move you to laughter and tears. How much more compelling, then, is God's movie, involving as it does the sense of depth, and not two senses only, but five. This life, however, is no more real than a movie. So everything that happens, just tell yourself, it isn't real. I'm experiencing it for a while, but don't take anything too seriously. Don't laugh too hard, don't cry too hard. Just know that it's all a part of God's dream. One thing that Master said is it's good to meditate on the horizon line. It's good to meditate on the central point between opposites. The horizon line divides the sky from the sea, and it's only one-dimensional. We banish the sense of two of those three dimensions when we concentrate on the horizon line. And going through that one dimension, we go into the dimensionless infinite. That's why he used to say, concentrate on this horizon line, which separates the subconscious from the conscious. And right between the subconscious and the conscious, if you can penetrate that fine line of consciousness, you enter into the dimensionless superconsciousness. Again, he said, always try to live at the center of things. Don't get yourself sucked into enjoying, or the yogi should always be even-minded. He can enjoy things, but always refer that joy back to yourself. Don't get excited by anything. Always be centered in yourself. The more you can see things at their center, in fact, it's a very interesting thing to practice, to try to go from your center, get to your center. If you've got a question of what you want to do, what you want the guidance for what you want to do, or if you're trying to find another person's difficulty so you can help him, or whether this is the right person to work with, or whatever it might be, the constant and countless questions and problems that arise in life. I've tried saying this before, and perhaps not with much success yet. I'm going to try once more. If you can get to your center, God is center everywhere, circumference nowhere. If from that level of consciousness you can touch the center of your problem, the center of the creative work you're trying to do, the center of the person you're trying to reach or understand, you will find that God there in him that's the same as the God in you, and you'll automatically know what to do. That's why to understand people, you can't understand them truly by analyzing and criticizing. You can only understand people truly if you have deep compassion for them. That sense of empathy, of identifying with them. So if you can feel your center and their center, and feel the God in both, and feel on that level of consciousness, in other words, then you will be able to understand them. And if you want to do a work, if you will try to get to the center of that work, that's a little harder to understand. But by center, I mean the God trying to manifest himself through that work. You will then understand how to make happen that which God would like to make happen. So live more at the center. The same thing is true with the spiritual path. The moderate way. Don't be a fanatic in anything. Don't go to extremes. You will find that the moderate way is the way of the Spirit. The noble path of moderation in everything. Between these extremes, you will find God is always there. Even in any discussion, if you can pull back from the two sides that are arguing, you'll find that the truth is almost invariably at some point right at the center between them. Master said, how did God, the one reality, manifest this universe of appearances? He did so through the law of duality. His one consciousness took on the appearance of opposites, of positive and negative, of light and darkness, of pleasure and pain, and so on to an infinity of contrasting illusions. A part of his consciousness moved, as the Bible tells us, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. We might compare that motion to the motion of waves on the surface of the ocean. The ocean level never changes, even when the waves rise very high, for every upward movement at one place is compensated for by a downward movement at another. The overall water level remains ever the same. Even so, God, the ocean of spirit, remains unaltered by his creation. At the surface of his consciousness, however, his spirit moves, and that movement or vibration produces duality, like the rising and falling of the waves on the sea. The Infinite One vibrated a part of himself to become two, then many, until the cosmic vibration produced stars and galaxies and planets, flowers and trees and human bodies. The cosmic vibration is called Om. It is the Amen in the Book of Revelation in the Bible. It is the Word in the Gospel of St. John. It is the music of the spheres of the ancient Greeks. It is the Amin of the Muslims, the Ahunavar of the Zoroastrians. Out of that great vibration, everything that is came into being. Vibration produces duality. To know the one reality behind all appearances, remove yourself mentally from nature's oppositional states. Accept with an even mind whatever comes to you in life, pleasure and pain, joy and sorrow, success and failure. Live for God alone, serve Him only, love only Him. And so in that way you will be able to rise above these appearances. But if you're caught in them, you'll never be able to do so. A question that comes up in people's minds is, well, if this is all just a dream, then what about evil? Is it just a dream? And does this mean that we can just do anything we want to? And it's all a dream, so what does it matter? Master addressed that question. Master inquired a disciple, what purpose does evil serve in God's creation? Surely the Lord is a God of goodness and love. Is it possible that as certain modern writers claim, he doesn't know evil? Sri Yogananda chuckled. God would have to be very stupid not to know evil. He who sees the fall of every sparrow, how could he not be aware of something so obvious? The disciple, perhaps he doesn't know it as evil. Yogananda, but the thing that makes it evil is the harm it does us. Certainly he is conscious that people are living in delusion and that therefore they suffer. He himself created this delusion. The disciple, then did God create evil? Yogananda, evil is his maya, or cosmic illusion. It is a conscious force which, once brought into existence, seeks self-perpetuation. Maya is Satan. It tries to keep our consciousness earthbound. God, the one reality, keeps trying at the same time to draw us back to himself by his divine love. The disciple, but then it must have been meant for Satan to play a role of the divine in the divine scheme of things. Yogananda, smiling, evil serves the same purpose as does the villain in a drama. The villain's misdeeds help to awaken in us love for the hero and for virtuous ways. Similarly, evil and its painful after effects are meant to awaken in us love for goodness and God. The disciple, but Master, if good and evil are both merely parts of a cosmic drama, what does it matter what roles we play in the story? Whether as saints or as gangsters, our parts will be illusory and won't affect our true nature as images of God. The Master laughed. You are right in the ultimate sense. But don't forget that if you play the part of a villain in a drama, in that drama you will also have to receive the villain's punishment. If, on the other hand, you play the role of a saint, you will awaken from this cosmic dream and enjoy oneness with the dreamer for all eternity. And so we come to the question of the soul and God, which is the last chapter, and I'll have to go quickly because I'm already out of time. But the issue is, what are we in reality? Master said, this chapter is called The Soul and God. Master said, God is the ocean of spirit, and human beings are like waves that rise and fall on the ocean's surface. From a rowboat, the waves appear endlessly varied. Some are large and threatening, others small and easy to row upon. From an airplane, however, all that is seen is the ocean itself, not the waves on its surface. Even so, to one who is absorbed in the play of Maya, attached to success and fearful of failure, attached to good health and fearful of illness, attached to earthly existence and fearful of death, the waves of human experience appear real and endlessly varied. To the man of non-attachment, however, all is Brahma, all is God. The greater a storm, the higher the waves on the ocean. Even so, the more violent the storm of delusion in a person's mind, the more he exalts himself above others and affirms his independence both of man and of God. How can anyone ever escape his Creator? We are all a part of God, even as waves are a part of the ocean. Our separateness from him is an appearance merely. When people affirm their individuality and thereby raise themselves up in vanity and pride, they crash aggressively against other ego waves that are whipped up like them by delusion storm. Like ocean waves in a tempest, they heave and toss about, conquering one minute, being conquered the next, in a ceaseless frenzy of conflict and competition. In a storm, the surface of the ocean knows no peace. Similarly, as long as the storm of delusion rages in the human mind, a person knows no peace but only tension and anxiety. Peace comes when the storm is stilled, whether outwardly in nature or inwardly in a person's consciousness. As the storm of Maya subsides, the waves of the ego subside also. As the devotee's ego diminishes, he relaxes and accepts once again his connection with the Infinite Spirit. Spiritually developed people no longer vie together, but splash about happily in cheerful harmony with one another, with nature, and with God. In the beginning, it's necessary to practice the yogic technique of just always saying, this is the technique of jnana yoga, neti neti, not this, not that. Whatever you enjoy, whatever you get, yes, but that's not what I'm really looking for. Doesn't mean you don't enjoy anything. I met one yogi who told me that one shouldn't enjoy the beauty of a sunrise, one shouldn't enjoy beautiful music, but that's not what Yogananda taught. Yogananda said, enjoy everything, but with the joy of God. And so, in the beginning, this thought of, it's sort of almost a cynical thought, well, this isn't really it, it's not that, it's not the other thing. It's, you sort of realize that you're not looking for that world out there. But then comes that inner sense of His presence, and then there should be the thought that all is God. God is in this, God is in that, enjoy all things with His joy. The Hindu teachings, Yogananda said, are pantheistic. Christian thinkers have twisted this fact into a denunciation of Hinduism. Their error lies in thinking pantheism means worshipping God as everything instead of as expressed in everything. Isn't it much sweeter to see His manifestations everywhere, His beauty in the sunset, His tears for human error in the rain, His tenderness expressed in a mother's love for her baby? If God is omnipresent, isn't it obvious that He must also be in everything? We must seek Him behind His veils. Even a veil, however, may suggest the form it hides. All things in creation, for those who love God, remind them of Him. Above all, remember, as Jesus said, the kingdom of God is within you. And so, what are we really? We think we are the ego, but we are really the soul. And what then is the ego? Master gave this answer. The ego is the soul attached to the body. We should live, therefore, as I said, superconsciously. Master said, self-realization means realizing your true self as the great ocean of spirit. By breaking the delusion that you are this little ego, this little human body and consciousness, live always in the thought of God within. We'll be talking more about the superconsciousness and how to live on that level in the classes to come. Thank you very much.